for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Next year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Eudora Welty. In 1943, William Faulkner wrote a letter to the up-and-coming writer telling her, "You're doing all right." Eudora Welty did more than all right. She won awards, acclaim, and a wide following. Today, she's often mentioned, right along with Faulkner, as one of the nation's most important writers. For this month's Reader's Review, we're going to talk about Eudora Welty's memoir, One Writer's Beginnings. We are actually going to hear Eudora Welty herself read a portion of one of those lectures. Joining me in the studio, author Kate Lehrer, Suzanne Mars. She's author of Eudora Welty, a biography, and poet Ethelbert Miller. And throughout the hour, I do certainly invite you to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Suzanne Mars, One Writer's Beginnings is certainly one of my very favorite, all-time favorite books. Tell us about the origins of the book.
Well, Daniel Aaron at Harvard University was visiting with Eudora Welty, and he said, "Well, why don't you come to Harvard and deliver a series of lectures called the Massey Lectures in the History of American Civilization?" And she said, "Oh, I don't do lectures." And he said, "Oh, you could talk about your beginnings as a writer." And she said, "Well, I think I could do that." And so she gave a series of three lectures at Harvard, which were a fabulous success. They had overflow audiences. They had to rig some sort of radio projection of it somehow, and so people could hear in other rooms.
I see.
Broadcast in
I
other
see.
Rooms. And people were sitting in the window seats, and when it was over, people marched in line to greet her and brought flowers. And so it was a tremendous success, and Harvard had always intended that this should be a book, and so she revised those lectures, the three lectures.
I see.
And this book is the revision of those three lectures.
I see. Kate Lehrer, what did you think when you first read this book?
Oh, I was blown away by this book. I mean, there's just simply no way not to. You see the genius of the woman, and as a writer, it just spoke in such a way. She talks about, she almost goes about it in a backward way. She, instead of abstraction, she says, "My work always comes from the particular to the general." And that is what she does in this book. She starts talking about her clocks in her family. And from that, she said, "I learned my first sense of time." And keep in mind that all this happens really with, most of it is within her first 10 years of life. So everything that's talked about here. But I think what struck me along with an almost how-to craft of writing from a way that nobody else is ever going to tell you is what it just prompts in anyone. You don't have to want to be a writer or even a reader to see how much it can influence and makes you start thinking about your own life and all the patterns and influences. She talks about revelation. It's just extraordinary.
Ethelbert, how about you? What happened to you the first time you read this book?
I think this book is very important in terms of what happens within Eudora Welty's household, the emphasis on reading. Many of us who want to become writers, I think many of our teachers would say a key thing to be a good writer is reading. I like the fact that, you know, her mother's reading to her in almost every room. I mean, today we look around, there's a TV in every room. So I like that aspect in terms of it, and especially the third part of this book, the third lecture. I think this really, when she's looking at specific stories, it's really almost like a how-to-do. But another thing which I draw out is I love the mother-daughter relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's something very intimate about it. You can see, for example, Eudora is drawing upon maybe her mother as a model for, you know, maybe she wasn't able to write. She read and everything, but here was a wonderful opportunity for her to live her mother's dreams even.
A little tension going on there between the mother and the daughter, Suzanne. And we should say that Eudora's father died when she was quite young.
He did. He died in 1931. She was 22. There was tension between mother and daughter. There was also devotion, I think, between
Absolutely.
Mother and daughter. And perhaps there was even tension because of the devotion, because Eudora wanted to please her mother, wanted to protect her mother. She hated going against her mother's wishes. On the other hand, she wanted that independence. And her mother wanted to protect her daughter, but she also wanted her daughter to thrive in her career. And so there was tension, but there was also devotion and love.
It was fascinating to me that, in fact, Eudora's father wanted her to have a career in business or something really financially stable.
Yes.
He thought of her going to New York.
Yes, and he thought this would be great. He wanted her to be able to support herself. And remember, she's growing up really in the Great Depression. This is her time that she's getting her education and trying to decide what to do. Her mother thinks that being a writer is fine because it's safe. I think her mother is always thinking she could just stay, come back home, which is, of course, what she does. But as she says, that tension with her mother is what informs so many of the themes in her work. I mean, her mother also was an independent spirit, she finally comes to realize. It created the strong bond. It also created that tension because her mother didn't really want her to be so independent. And the torment and guilt that's always there, because that's, and it's huge in her work, she says, and it certainly is, that she feels tormented. Her mother feels tormented when she leaves, when Eudora leaves to go away. And Eudora always felt guilty. She calls it, I think, the iron cage of guilt closes in around her.
And is it, Ethelbert, simply because she, Eudora, is leaving, or is it because she, Eudora, feels that her mother sacrificed so much for her?
I think you could probably wonder what happens when Eudora discovers those love letters between her mother and father. I mean, that reveals a lot to this relationship. I think also the loss of a child before she was born. There's a lot of things that she's revealing in this book that I think shapes her view of her mother and her family.
There is a tiny story here, but so important. When, as a young child, Eudora finds two nickels. And immediately she finds them in her mother's drawer. And she immediately wants to go out and spend them. Tell us about those nickels.
She finds these two nickels in her mother's drawer in a box covered with cotton, and they're shiny and bright, and she wants to spend them. And she goes to her mother and says, "Can I go to the store and spend them?" And her mother says immediately and harshly, "No." And then her mother tells her what she has never told her before, that Eudora had a brother who was born before she was born and who died, and these nickels had been placed on his eyes, as she says, for some purpose unimaginable. And so she learns something about mortality here, about her mother's deep grief, a father who cannot speak of it, the child who has died. Her mother might die. She might die. This powerful revelation, this moment of revelation, as Kate says, comes to her.
Yes. What is so wonderful about every story she tells in this book, it's never just for itself. It's for how it helps, how it's a larger theme.
Much
in everything.
Larger.
And for instance, this she sort of puts under secrets. And the secret she was very much wanting to know and bugging her mother about was how our baby's born. How our baby's born. And she said sometimes one secret is given in the place of another. And in this case, the second secret, the one that's substituted, can be the much more appalling secret, which is a baby can die, therefore can she die? The mother almost died. She knows this. I mean, as you know, Suzanne says, it's all there. And what that means, and what that means when you're a fiction writer.
And it comes into her fiction, of course, all the time,
yes.
Because it's this powerful sense of mortality and the urgency that brings to live your life as fully as possible.
That's right.
So over and over, this is a theme in her work.
Suzanne, Eudora never wanted what she said was a biography. Yet, I gather, she did collaborate with you on a biography.
Well, I had known her for many years. We met in 1983, and I didn't intend to write a biography. But in 1998, I thought I would like to do that. And I went to her, and a friend of mine said, when you ask Eudora about writing the biography, don't ask her to let her to let you do it for your sake, for her sake. Ask her to let you do it for your own. And so I said, Eudora, would you do me a great favor and allow me to write your biography? And immediately she said yes.
Oh, my.
And it was an act of friendship for me, and a great act of friendship.
How long did the biography take you, and did you work very closely with her?
Well, not really at that point, but I had been working on her fiction for almost 20 years by that time. And so then we talked again, of course, but she opened up to me all of her correspondence.
Suzanne Marr, she's professor of English and Welty Foundation Scholar in Residence at Millsaps College. She's the author of Eudora Welty, A Biography. We'll take a short break. When we come back, you will hear Eudora Welty read from her own work.
I'm prepared now to use the wonderful word confluence, which of itself is a kind of touchstone, a reality and a symbol in one, the only kind of symbol that for me has any weight, testifying to the pattern, one of the chief patterns of human experience. Here in this paragraph, I'm building to the last scenes in a novel I call The Optimist Daughter. She had slept in the chair, like a passenger who had come on an emergency journey in a train, but she had rested deeply. She had dreamed that she was a passenger, and riding with Phil, they had ridden together over a long bridge. Awake, she recognized it. It was a dream of something that had really happened. When she and Phil were coming down from Chicago to Mount Salis to be married in the Presbyterian Church, they came on the train. Laurel, when she traveled back and forth between Mount Salis and Chicago, had always taken the sleeper. She and Phil followed the route on the day train, and she saw it for the first time. When they were climbing the long approach to a bridge after leaving Cairo, rising slowly higher until they rode above the tops of bare trees, she looked down and saw the pale light widening and the river bottoms opening out, and then the water appearing, reflecting the low, early sun. There were two rivers. Here was where they came together. This was the confluence of the waters, the Ohio and the Mississippi. They were looking down from a great elevation, and all they saw was at the point of coming together, the bare trees marching in from the horizon, the rivers moving into one. And as he touched her arm, she looked up with him and saw the long, ragged, pencil-faint line of birds within the crystal of the zenith, flying in a V of their own, following the same course down. All they could see was sky, water, birds, light, and confluence. It was the whole morning world. And they themselves were part of the confluence. Their own joint act of faith had brought them here at the very moment and matched in its occurrence, as preceded as it preceded. Direction itself was made beautiful, momentous. They were riding as one with it, right up front. It's our turn, she thought exultantly, and we're going to live forever. Left bodiless and graveless of a death made of water and fire and a year long gone, Phil could still tell her of her life. For her life, any life, she had to believe, was nothing but the continuity of its love. She believed that just as she believed that the confluence of the waters was still happening at Cairo, it would be there the same as it ever was when she went flying over it today on her way back, out of sight for her this time, thousands of feet below, but with nothing in between except thin air. Of course, the greatest confluence of all is that which makes up the human memory, the individual human memory. My own is the treasure most dearly regarded by me in my life and in my work as a writer. Here, time also is subject to confluence. The individual human memory is a living thing. It, too, is in transit. But during its moment, all that is remembered joins and lives, the old and the young, the past and the present, the living and the dead, all vocal. As you have seen, I'm a writer who came of a sheltered life. A sheltered life can be a daring life, too, for all serious daring starts from within.
And that was Eudora Welty delivering the third and final lecture at Harvard University, the William E. Massey Senior Lectures in the History of American Civilization, 1983. Those three lectures, the final of which was titled Finding a Voice, were delivered in 1983 and became the book we all know and love, One Writer's Beginnings by Eudora Welty. And joining me here in the studio, Kate Lehrer, Ethelbert Miller, and Suzanne Massey, who is the biographer of Eudora Welty. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's a lovely email from Melanie in Fort Worth, Texas, who says, in 1990, I worked at New Stage Theater in Jackson, Mississippi. The theater was located about a block from Miss Welty's home. Everyone in town just called her Miss Welty. Several times a week, you could see Miss Welty walking from her house down to the Jitney Jungle grocery store a few blocks away. There was an old pharmacy with a soda fountain next to the Jitney, and I think she may have had lunch there on most days, so I'm not sure. I'll always remember seeing her walking down the street and thinking how many other of her fans would like to be able to see it. What a lovely memory.
What a wonder.
Yes.
And hearing her read Kate Lehrer.
Oh, it just breaks you up. I mean, I decided this morning I was reading a paragraph that comes just before that to my husband and couldn't even read it myself. And that's not even in Eudora's voice, to put it mildly. But her writing is just so exquisite in its simplicity. And she tells you so much. She just tells you so much. There's right before that, she talks about this character who she thinks all of her subjects are there. And when she says, this woman is, you know, cantankerous. She's not at all like Eudora was. But she's talking about the solitary core where everybody has to go to find a voice. And she'd certainly found hers. And goes on to say, But this woman, she knows to the last that there is a world that remains out there, that a world living, that is a world living and mysterious, and that she is of it. And you feel that that's part of what Eudora's whole message is, that that idea of the imagination connecting you to somewhere else.
There's also a wonderful connection here between two major American writers. I listen to Eudora Welty, and immediately I'm thinking of Langston Hughes in The Big Sea, where he's also going down the Mississippi, where he's also looking at the water, and his sense of, Eudora talks about memory, Langston's talking about the rivers, and it has the same effect, and also the fact they're both on these trains, which is another way of discovering America. And there's other passages in Eudora's book where she's talking about the train and just how the person prepares the sleeping arrangements. I mean, it's so precise that, you know, you can see her also as a photographer, which is another, her eye is really developed.
Absolutely. And those photographs are really how she began. The photographs came
Well, she was writing and taking pictures simultaneously.
What was she photographing?
She photographed life in Mississippi primarily, people going to church or having bird pageants in the church or going about their daily business, doing the laundry and
how would
the
you describe
out.
Her eye?
Oh, I'm not a photographer, but to me her eye is very precise, the framing of the photographs. She said you need to know the moment to snap the shutter, the gesture, the revealing gesture. That's the moment you snap the shutter. And I think she often got that just right. I mean, there may be a series of photographs, but she knew which was the best one. Yes. Yeah.
And it's the same thing she says about writing the story. You have to know the moment you've got the story. Mm-hmm. And she compared it to knowing when to snap the shutter, and the same with snapping the story. You have to have it. But she had always had her keenness, her physical awareness as a child, tiny child, is really extraordinary.
Exactly. And it's in that listening.
Yes.
I mean, you talked about the clocks and the listening to the sound of the clock, listening to, I mean, I used to wake up and go downstairs to breakfast and hear my mother doing her exercises on the floor, and that told me that life in the house was to begin. Every sound is important.
Also every sound, and also here, especially in terms of being a Southern writer, her ear and her listening to the Black oral tradition, you know, when she talks about Fanny, the old Black sewing woman.
Yes.
You know, and who has all the gossip, you know. And she says Fanny didn't bother about the ear she was telling it to. She just liked telling. And she was like the author. And you begin to see that her understanding, you know, of Black culture, it's very, very moving. And I went back, I was reading her story about, you know, the Michael Evers assassination, which is, you know, basically where the voice coming from, where she says in the book, it's one story that she wrote with anger. And getting inside this assassin's, you know, mind and lifestyle and the relationship with his wife is key to understanding why this guy did what he did.
Talk about the Black woman whose stories she was listening to. I mean, they were so important to her.
She said
because she talked in a way that perhaps her mother did not talk.
Right. Fanny, the sewing woman, was ready to tell all. She had been in every house in the neighborhood. She knew the secrets that were in every house in the neighborhood. And her mother wanted to shelter her from this gossip. She said gossip sounded like measles. It was something you could catch. And so she loved Fanny. And Eudora once told me, somebody asked her to come and speak, and they said to her, you know, don't read your story. Just put it in your own words. Just tell it to us in your own words. And she said, well, I thought that's what I was doing in my stories. But she said, people in the South would say, if you hear it, tell it. And that's what Fanny was doing.
And I like the fact that Fanny would tell the story with the pins in her mouth.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we've all met Eudora. What was she like in person, Kate?
Oh, I found her she's just an extraordinary person. She has a great sense of humor, as everybody knows, and she saw the humor in everything. She could see the humor in really a mural on the wall. Oh, look at that little bird. What do you think that little bird is doing? It all comes back from this Southern storytelling tradition that she could share her eye. And this is an old age that she was picking up all these things. But I tell you what I think really struck me the first time I saw this done. She was very modest, very unassuming, very much with a sense of humor. But she got up on a stage, and she was somebody else. She had a presence. She was Eudora Welty. And always she knew exactly who she was. It was never that she didn't. But when she got up on the stage, she was an actress.
The two, you know, when I met her at some of the Penn Faulkner gathering, the person she reminded me of in terms of, you know, stature and all was Gwendolyn Brooks. You know, here were women who shaped American letters.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would read them about them in school and things of that sort. But when you met them, this humility was something that if you were a writer, that's what you really want to learn.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How did you first meet her?
I had written to her, to Miss Welty, as I then called her, and asked for an interview, and I never got an answer to my letter. And so I came on to the Department of Archives and History in Jackson, and her old friend Charlotte Capers arranged for us to meet. And when I got to Eudora's house and we began to talk, at some point she said to me, "Now, I hope you're not trying to turn me into an agrarian." In my letter, I had written to her about an essay I was writing, and I was linking her to the Nashville agrarians. And so, of course, I was trying to turn her into an agrarian, but she said, "I hope you're not trying to turn me into an agrarian." So that was our first conversation. It got better from that point. But she did it in such a nice way that I wasn't offended at all. I was mighty glad she had corrected me, and she was right.
I know that you have certainly read everything that Eudora Welty has written. How do you think that one writer's beginnings compares with her fiction?
Well, I, of course, love the fiction above all, and I think I probably love the golden apples above all of her works, and she has a good bit about the golden apples in One Writer's Beginnings. But I think One Writer's Beginnings is a wonderful work on its own and stands with the fiction, on par with the fiction. I'd be interested to know what the real writers here think about that.
I think so, too.
You
I
do,
Kay. I truly
Kate.
Think so, yes. Uh-huh. I find it extremely moving. And as I say, it's accessible to everybody.
Absolutely.
Not everybody's going to get in her fiction anymore, the Southern humor even. I mean, it's a different sort of thing. But in her fiction, I mean, in this book, I think it's got such a universal appeal. Her fiction does too, but it's different. And
you know, I think you know, having written a memoir, you know, I'm looking at the courage it takes to write about your family. You know, I mean, she's telling, you know, in this book, family secrets, really,
and
a public domain. She's not like writing about it. She's actually giving these lectures, and I thought that's very courageous, especially when you look at the fact that she was considered a very shy and sheltered person. So, you know, maybe this is because at the end of her life, she's changing, but still, that's still a tremendous amount of courage.
I think, too, this book is so wonderfully structured. It's not a book that begins, "I was born," and
exactly.
proceeds
right.
to,
right. Exactly.
I'm now 75
right.
years old.
Right.
It uses the principle of confluence.
Right.
You have episodes juxtaposed that speak to each other, and she's discovering patterns in her life that chronology can't reveal.
That word, confluence, she put such emphasis
yes.
on it, talking about the inside and the outside, the beginning and the end, and everything all around us.
Yes, and she talks about this in relation to chronology at one point, close to the end. She's talked about chronology all the way through, the idea of the time clocks and all that, but that our chronology, our inner chronology, and it's used in stories and telling the stories, is to do with the revelations that it takes all the memories. It's the hindsight. Even in her writing, she says it's looking back that she sees where the themes are. So therefore, every story is a very different story, and it's every story is a risk that she writes. And in our lives, we see things at different points in our lives in different ways.
Now, I want to read once again those last two sentences of this book when she says, "As you have seen, I am a writer who came out of a sheltered life. A sheltered life can be a daring life as well, for all serious daring starts from within." I had a note yesterday from Mary Chapin Carpenter, and those words of Eudora Welty's inspired the writing of this song.
Late one night when the wind was still, Daddy brought the baby to the windowsill to see a bit of heaven shoot across the sky. The one and only time Daddy saw it fly. It came from the east just as bright as a torch. The neighbors had a party on their porch. Daddy rocked the baby, mother said amen, when Hallie came to visit in 1910.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Across 110th Street. On the next Fresh Air, rhythm and blues singer Bobby Womack. He started out in gospel music, but Sam Cooke encouraged him to head in a more secular direction. The Soul Years, a new Bobby Womack Best Of compilation, has just come out. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And just before the break, of course, we heard just a tiny bit of that wonderful Mary Chapin Carpenter song about Halley's Comet, which apparently Eudora's dad showed to her in 1910. Suzanne.
He did. He was very much interested in astronomy and showing his children all through their lives the stars. And so he carried Eudora to the window when Halley's Comet came through in 1910, showed his one-year-old daughter Halley's Comet.
His one-year-old daughter. Isn't that wonderful? All right, let's go open the phones now, first to Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you so much. Briefly, I just wanted to thank you and your panel for this segment, for keeping the memory of Miss Eudora Welty alive. I'm originally from the Mississippi Delta, and the great pantheon of Mississippi writers still, I believe, Faulkner, Tennessee Williams, Miss Welty, Ellen Douglas, Ellen Gilchrist, have such a profound effect on the world, and I'm just glad that your panelist is participating in this to keep this alive. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard, and I'm sure in this 100th year, there will be an awful lot written and spoken about Eudora Ethelbert.
And also, this is the 100th year of another Mississippi writer, that's Richard Wright.
Right.
Exactly.
Let me say that in Jackson, the Eudora Welty Foundation is going to be sponsoring many, many events celebrating the birth of Eudora Welty. And so I hope people will come to Jackson for those events.
And it's actually a year from now,
yes,
2009.
And visit the Eudora Welty House, which is one of the most intact literary house museums in the country. It's now open for visitors.
Talk about that house, Suzanne. What is, her dad built it, did he not?
He did. He was president of the Lamar Life Insurance Company, or vice president at the time he was building it, and he was in charge of building this wonderful skyscraper in Jackson, the only skyscraper in Jackson at that time. And the same architect built the house, and the family moved there in 1925, and Eudora lived there until her death. In 2001.
2001. She was 92.
Right.
At the time. Ethelbert.
I was wondering, maybe Suzanne, she could talk about a person who is mentioned in the book, and that is Mrs. Calloway, the librarian.
Right. That's a false name for Mrs. Calloway. For protecting her identity. But Mrs. Calloway limited the number of books a person could take from the library, and Eudora was, dying to read all the time.
A
voracious reader. So she would take her two books, ride her bicycle back home through the bottom of the state capital of Mississippi, read her books, and come back. I think Mrs. Calloway limited her to a day, didn't she? She couldn't bring them back the same day.
All right, to Ellicott City, Maryland. Good morning, Karen.
Thank you. What a marvelous gift this book. I don't recall exactly what I expected when I first went to read it, but what I was given was another collection of stories, and even the smallest stories or the fragments of stories are so full of images, and I often think of this is just a tiny snippet, but when she writes of her mother as a young woman leaving the home every day, riding a horse with a younger brother down to the river and taking this boat, rowing across the river, it's a journey, and it's almost like a fairy tale or like mythology. It's just so wonderful to read. I'm so glad you're talking about it today.
Thank you very much, Karen. Suzanne, any comments?
I love that story about her mother because her mother was a daring woman, going to teach in a little one-room school and having the fathers show up and having to tell the fathers if they misbehaved, she'd whip them too, just as she would the children. And then her mother and father marrying and leaving West Virginia, leaving her home in West Virginia, going to
really
Jackson.
Really courageous.
A time when you couldn't just phone up. You couldn't come back easily. So it was really displaying a kind of independent spirit, one that Eudora emulated, I think.
Here's an email from Betsy who says, Eudora Welty was a writer in residence at Smith College, where I attended. I had the wonderful opportunity of interviewing her for the college alumni magazine. She gave me, a nervous, fledgling writer, her full and warm attention. My strongest impression of her was a true Southern lady without the starch.
I think that's exactly how I felt about her. She says that beautifully.
Doesn't she, though?
Exactly, without the starch.
All right, to Truro, Massachusetts. Hi there, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. In 2004, my partner Jim went to Washington, D.C., and he came back with Eudora Welty's book, One Time, One Place. And I have to tell you, it is one of my most treasured pieces. I'm a writer myself, and it's just one of my most treasured books. I pick it up every once in a while, and I peruse the pages and the pictures. What she did with the pictures and the photographs, I mean, it makes you you feel like you're there. You feel like you could just reach out and touch these people. I mean, the simplicity of them and the pure majesty of them. It's just beautiful. the black and whites. It's just a gorgeous book.
Suzanne.
That's a book of photographs she took primarily in the 1930s, they weren't published until one time, one place was published in 1971. So she just published Losing Battles, her novel, and then she published this wonderful book of photographs. I think it is a jewel.
We should bring up, too, that she was doing this photography for the government, really, the state, I guess.
No, not this one. She wasn't doing the photography for the government. She was working for the WPA for about 6 months of the time. But she took the photographs for herself.
Just for herself.
Yeah, but she was traveling for the WPA, so it gave her
an opportunity to do. Okay, because I knew they did a lot of art. They sort of supplemented artists. Pay, gave them money, period, by going around and doing things like that. So I have always assumed that was part of it. No.
She would have liked that. She applied for it, but didn't get it.
It's a wonderful thing for those who are in creative writing programs to get out of the programs and see America.
Exactly. Here's an email from Andrew in Brooklyn, Michigan. Could you please talk about Eudora Welty's childhood friendship with Milton Babbitt?
Milton Babbitt's father worked for the Lamar Life Insurance Company, as Eudora Welty's did, and so they knew each other. I don't think that they were, I think Milton Babbitt was somewhat younger than Eudora, so that they wouldn't have been playmates or anything of that sort, but they knew each other, they maintained their connection, and remained friends all their lives.
And what about her relationship beyond that comment that William Faulkner made about her writing? Did their relationship continue beyond that, Suzanne?
She met William Faulkner sometime after that. She was at Oxford, and a mutual friend had a dinner party, and they were both at the dinner party. And after dinner, someone went to the piano, and they began to sing hymns. The next day, William Faulkner took Eudora and her friend John Robinson out for a sail in his boat on Sardis Lake. She loved Faulkner's work, and she really liked him. And they were not close friends, but they did maintain, you know, a connection. In 1962, she gave him an award in New York, presented him with an award.
You know what strikes me? Her work seems so much more accessible than Faulkner's, and yet she did love his writing.
Oh, yes. Well, for her, it would have been very accessible, Faulkner's work, because it's that same rolling cadence that, as she says, all Southern writers get out of the King James Version of the Bible, just to begin with. That's what they read. That's what they all knew. And I think to her, his work would have been very accessible. Plus, she's just so brilliant. And part of the story, the way I've heard about Faulkner going out on the boat, because, again, she always injected a self-deprecating humor. So she went out. She's very excited to be out on the boat. And she's very shy and doesn't want to initiate anything because he's the great man and she's the fledgling writer. And then he doesn't speak to her. I mean, they're in silence now. I don't know if that's just apocryphal or real, but it's a wonderful way she would tell that story.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. I never heard it that way.
Yes, and it would be, you know, and it was this comic story. Again, she is with the great man, and she's really beside herself, and he doesn't talk. I mean, he's not a talker.
Oh, dear.
She felt she saw a sort of sadness in Faulkner. I mean, she had a real sense of his personality there. Another funny thing about that day with Faulkner is that she had to wade out to get in the boat, and she had worn some nice shoes, and so she
had to wade out. Well, let's talk about the fact that in 1988 she became the first living writer to be included in the Library of America series of collected works. What did that mean, Suzanne?
Well, I think it's a tremendous tribute to her work, to the achievements of her lifetime, that she would be honored by the Library of America. And it means a lot to us because it guarantees that her work will always be in print.
How did she react get you that award?
She was very pleased when the Library of America began, and was a big supporter of the Library of America and had purchased a subscription to it, so the books always came. So I think it was a great thrill to be included with those writers that she admired so much.
Kate Lehrer, Eudora Welty loved your husband,
yes.
Jim Lehrer, loved Roger Mudd.
Yes.
Though when those two men were around, it was as though Eudora almost had eyes for no one else.
Exactly. They were her little coterie of boyfriends. Yes, she loved Robin McNeil, too, but she loved them, and she didn't. At the same time, if one of the wives happened to be around, she was wonderful and very respectful. We were down there once. I thought of this earlier, just in terms of this Southern woman kindness. She was a Southern lady, that she and Jim were going to lunch, actually with New York Times reporters. He had a play going on down there. And she got very worried about what I would do. That was a working lunch. It was a very professional thing. And so what should I do during this period? And I couldn't, and I was working myself on my own book. So I was perfectly happy to have all the day to myself. She saw to it that this woman that Suzanne mentioned earlier, Charlotte Capers, took me to lunch. And that was quite a lunch, because Charlotte said, well, I can't really drink today, because she had had her eyes dilated and she had had something done to her foot. So she was on a crutch, and she drove us out on this highway. Forget the name of that restaurant, but we're sitting out there, same restaurant Jim and Eudora are in. And Charlotte orders for lunch, since she can't drink, a bourbon on the rocks. And I'm kind of like, you know, and that was the first, and then there was a second, and I thought, we're going to get home, you know.
Well, as Eudora once said to me about drinking, when I asked her if I could pour a second drink, she said, you can't fly on just one wing.
So she and Charlotte were best friends.
Right. At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Kathleen, who's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning to you.
Hi, Diane, and hi, Ethelbert. This is Kathleen Reed. I just wanted to ask a question about Toni Morrison wrote a book called Playing in the Dark, Whiteness in the Literary Imagination. And she talks about the Africanist presence that's always at the backdrop of a lot of, quote, American literature. And today we're dealing with this whole issue about how can we bring our country together. And one of the things about Welty's writing was that she had that integration, that voice that brought two worlds very closely together. And I just wanted you to talk about the Africanist presence, and if you think that her work can help us hear one another's mutual and common voices.
Interesting.
Well, I think in the title, Where's the Voice Coming From, you really see that she's inside a white person's voice, but she understands the dynamics of race outside, race and class. And so I think I laugh when you make reference to Toni Morrison, because I think Morrison telling us that Bill Clinton was the first black president is still something we're wrestling with. But I think Eudora Welty is definitely right at that you really want to read and get an understanding of what it means to be American. And I think Toni Morrison is also part of this tradition, too.
What should would-be writers take from this book?
Well, one of the things is that Eudora Welty's father, the first book, he gave her a dictionary. You know, I would say every father give their children dictionaries.
I think, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the titles of the lectures are interesting. Listening, Learning to See, Finding a Voice. And they move from the most passive, although listening can be a very active activity,
absolutely,
to the most active, mm-hmm, finding your own voice. And mm-hmm, those are stages I think writers go through as they're developing.
And I just simply think anybody who wants to write should actually read this book, and they'll know exactly what they're taking. One of her very last major subjects in this book goes back to going to your solitary core and figuring out from that where your real voice is. Finding my voice is not an easy thing. You don't start with your voice. You write and you write, and then you find that voice, and then you use that voice.
And we should live a daring life.
And we should live,
yes,
a daring life.
Yes.
No matter what our beginnings.
Yes, it's a risk within that you take.
I think she said no good writing ever came out of failing to take a risk. You have to take those risks.
Suzanne Marsh, she's professor of English, Welty Foundation Scholar in Residence at Millsaps College, and author of Eudora Welty, a Biography. Kate Lehrer, whose most recent book is Confessions of a Bigamist, and E. Ethelbert Miller, poet and director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.